Hello, Mage fans, and welcome to Reality Deviants Book Club. This is the show where those of us who agree to disagree with reality discuss entries from the recommended reading lists in Mage Books. I'm your host, Adam, and I'm joined once again by co-host Puka. If you're looking for thoughtful, intelligent discussion of books recommended by Mage authors, you need to keep looking. But if you want to hear us talk about a book, you've clicked on the right link. Our podcast producer asked us to remain coherent for the recording. I'll try, but no promises. Puka's grinning. Is that a good sign? If you're looking for rants and problematic statements, you probably won't have to wait long. Before we get going, our legal team states, opinions expressed on Reality Deviants Book Club really do not express the views of Mage the Podcast. In fact, you probably shouldn't listen to these guys at all. Don't you wish you had a legal team? Some of our listeners let us know what they thought of the first episode. One writes, Puka was brilliant, but as for Adam, how did God, with all his tornadoes, miss that particular trailer park? Well, I guess you can't please everyone. Another writes, I have been so pleased with the intelligent discussions on this podcast. It has been uplifting. But please tell me, who let those two book club people on? Can this be addressed? Thank you for writing in. We have a committee investigating that. They will report their findings soon. Enough feedback. Puka, are you ready to talk about comics?
Almost always. Born ready.
I'm no expert on Changeling the Dreaming, but Puka tells me Puka are a Kith from that game, a player character option, and they're known for their reliability. So if you think I'm not on the level, you can trust him. Today we're talking about John Constantine Hellblazer by DC Comics, which shifted to their Vertigo label in later years. It ran from July 1988 to 2013, and if my sources are correct, had 300 issues. This comic was the first to feature John Constantine as the main character. He started as a support character in Saga of the Swamp Thing number 37 in 1985. The character was created by Alan Moore, Steve Bissett, and John Totleman. The character soon became popular and appeared in numerous titles. As of this recording, the character had a Hollywood movie, a TV series, and another animated TV series. Whether or not Constantine appeared in the Netflix Sandman series is something fans still can't figure out. Today we're focusing on Hellblazer. Mage Books recommend Hellblazer 5 times, but only in the first 2 editions of Mage. This suggests the Mage authors favored the early issues, but I don't want to speak for them. The first edition rulebook, the first Book of Madness, Book of Worlds, Book of Mirrors, and Destiny's Price recommend it. First edition rulebook states, various comics in this new imprint of DC Comics are incredibly useful for Mage. This is an obvious one. Book of Madness states, this series has been mentioned before, but inspires especially potent visions of demons, spirit entities, and astral travel. In revised edition, the Hollow One's book mentions one of the character templates liked Hellblazer in her youth, but that doesn't really qualify as a recommendation. First point to bring up is pronunciation. Alan Moore named the character and pronounces it Constantine. Americans have long pronounced it Constantine, and the 2005 Hollywood movie reinforced that. This looks like a case of American versus British pronunciation. A person could argue Alan Moore's pronunciation is the correct one, but he plucked the name from history. I found sources online stating the Roman emperor's name was pronounced Constantinus in ancient times, although they stated there are records of other pronunciations in the ancient world. I say Constantine, but rather than standing with my fellow Americans, you should remember, Reality Deviants don't care about rules. We say whatever we want. How do you pronounce it, Puka?
I hate to say it, but I think the Keanu Reeves film has corrupted me into saying Constantine rather than Constantine. But I remember when
another
it came
youth
out,
corrupted by Hollywood.
But I remember it sounded weird to me. Now I suppose I could go either way, and it depends upon the company one keeps, I think.
Well, when I was younger, my comic reading friends never mentioned Hellblazer. I read it for the first time for this episode. Years ago, I ran an online Mage Chronicle. One player was very capable and had excellent attendance. He played a streetwise hermetic who helped a lot in tracking down the main villain. Towards the end of the Chronicle, I complimented him on his great character. He told me he based the character on John Constantine from Hellblazer. I had that hermetic character in mind while I was reading the comic. Hellblazer is a long-running comic, so there's no central story or conflict. John Constantine is a regular person who grew up in modern-day England and studied magic as a teenager. His knowledge of magic and his contacts in the magic community make him aware of supernatural problems. He uses his Western-style magic to solve problems and chase away threats. We see him banish a demon spirit that escaped captivity, shut down a secret organization experimenting on psychics, stop a serial killer, and stop several schemes of demons to gain influence in the world. He does his best to help those in need, but at times he gives in to selfishness and fear. Some would call him an anti-hero, but I think he qualifies as a hero. He puts his life at risk many times for others, yet there are times he will allow someone else to die in his place. His vagabond appearance and informal, low-class style gives others a negative impression, but in the world of magic, nothing is as it appears. If I had to describe John Constantine, I would say he's a clever blend of the reluctant hero and the trickster. When I say trickster, I'm talking about Anansi the spider from West African legends and Coyote from Native American legends. He defeats opponents much stronger than himself through trickery. His magical might is not that strong, and he gets in over his head but finds opportunities to slip out at the last moment. Part of the fun of Hellblazer stories is wondering how he's going to turn things around in the last scene. This is a good point to consider where John Constantine might fit into the world of darkness. Some would consider him a hermetic, others a hollow one or independent orphan. He doesn't easily fit into one of the mage factions. In Hellblazer, he comes across as a hedge wizard to me. He doesn't use magic often, his power does not appear great, and he can only do some hypnotism without careful preparation. When Neil Gaiman was writing this character, and this character appeared in books of magic, he seemed like a mage there. He seems to primarily do spirit summoning and hypnotism, but there's the occasional minor trick that doesn't fit those categories. Puka, I'd like to hear your thoughts on Constantine and the Hellblazer comic title.
So my primary point of reference for the character was actually Sandman at first, because he turns up in the third issue just as a guest, but he made a strong impression as a sort of cheeky occult know-it-all who's able to navigate encounters with the big leaguers, in that case, Morpheus, the manifestation of the concept of dreams. And then, as you said, he turns up in the Books of Magic, he pops up in an issue of Lucifer. I'm sure I read an issue of Swamp Thing or Hellblazer back in the day, but those other sources are what gave me my idea of him as this one-off character. And then, as I said, the film came out. And for better or worse, the film really did shape my perception of him. Whereas in the comics, he has kind of a gritty, amoral, but charismatic quality to him. The film, if we accept that as another valid interpretation of his character, shows the sort of bitter, world-weary side. He still has moments of heroism in both cases, but not necessarily someone who's fun to be around. And putting aside all of the scuttlebutt about, oh, he was inspired by Sting, how dare they make him an American, or whatever, I really enjoy seeing that trope of humans surviving primarily by his wits alone in an unforgiving supernatural world kind of thing. For Hellblazer proper, the series, a friend of mine referred to the early issues as Swamp Thing fanfiction, and I think it really does show in some of those earlier arcs. So I really knew it more by reputation more than anything else before reading it for this podcast, apart from the odd panel or page that a friend had shared with me. I give it a lot of respect for being the first title moved into the Vertigo imprint, because so many other comics that I love were under that label as well. That being said, I do think the comic landscape of the late 80s and early 90s, when Hellblazer was launched, could be, let's say, self-involved in its own edginess. And so before reading this series from the beginning, I kind of suspected that whatever scraps I had in mind about the later issues and the later characterizations wouldn't necessarily resemble what we read for today.
Well, let's get into the questions. Puka, what did you like about Hellblazer?
Oh, there's a lot. like I've said before, artwork is always something I pay attention to in comics and graphic novels. There are some great moments in here, but late 80s comics art often requires some thorough staring at the page to parse what's going on. They like to cram lots of little details into every panel using very dense line work and shading, and then also fit a ton of panels onto the page, so it can be a little bit of a headache to follow the storyline correctly. But then when you reread, you spot all of these Easter eggs, and you're like, oh, cool, now I see that connection. It's just the first time through can be a little dizzying. But I appreciate some of the risks taken here with the unusual panel shapes and layouts, and some of the scenes are truly viscerally disgusting. So that's cool. In terms of the content of the story, I like how we regularly swing back and forth between scenes and stories that are very much in, quote, real world stuff versus the sort of raw pandemonium of the fantastic and the supernatural. There are lots of allusions to British politics and society of the time, and I was into the fervent anti-Thatcher tone, but maybe not so much the doomsaying that crops up here and there. It's not as apparent in the first trade paperback or two, but I've heard that Constantine is one of the few comics characters who ages in real time. We get a moment where he comments that it's his 35th birthday, so you can actually align his age with the noteworthy events in his life with the backdrop of real-world issues. And that's kind of a rare thing in comics. It gets outside the timeless atmosphere that comics often thrive on, but I like it. And I like that there's a protagonist who's a bit older and wearier, but still capable of knocking heads and taking names. That grounding also helps with the portrayal of subtle magics and little rituals, as you were saying. To use the mage term, there's not a lot of truly vulgar magic happening in the physical world here, at least not done by humans. There are moments when other worlds or beings from them intrude, and that's where you see a lot of the truly fantastical stuff, but John himself isn't throwing fireballs or flying through the air or whatnot. I personally prefer that in my modern fantasy. Or, if I dare use the term, I like that street-level stuff. I know people get worked up about it, but, you know, I still like when those magical bits are just odd and unsettling and incidental, when they're slowly and carefully unfolding behind closed doors, generally. I'd like to think Constantine could throw a fireball down the street if he wanted, but it's just not his style. And setting that from the start is a wise choice. I'd be curious if that's actually maintained through the series, but, you know.
I really liked the Constantine character. He's a snappy dresser. He has an everyman attitude you don't often see in comics. He's funny. He's sly. His personality has a real effect on the story, so it stands out in a way that's interesting from so many other comics. Many comics of the time attracted attention through a colorful costume, interesting powers, or, you know, superpowers, or distinctive villains. Hellblazer was supported by Constantine's personality. The writer didn't have an easy task. In the 80s, DC and Marvel were making their money on superheroes. Sword and sorcery, soldier, war comics, and other varieties were at a low ebb. G.I. Joe was one exception, but every character had a distinctive outfit and weapons. You could argue it leaned into superhero territory. DC took a chance on Hellblazer, and I'm glad they did. I like the complexity of many of the situations portrayed. There's rarely a right or wrong choice to make. Constantine has to make tough choices and live with the consequences. Very World of Darkness. I also like the portrayal of a world where magic is hiding just beneath the surface of the world we know. Some characters sense it and try to ignore it. Some embrace it recklessly for power. John Constantine treats it like a high-caliber pistol, a useful tool, but destructive, noisy, and something you don't want to use often. Puka, where did Hellblazer fall short?
Well, as much as I might agree with some of the politics that are in the pages, I think the politics, again, are a sticking point. So it's true that including current events and real-world issues creates a mood, but there are times when, man, does it get preachy. And sometimes that commentary overshadows the actual plot, which I think can be a problem. And then there's the shock value of having a so-called mature comic, where we regularly get misogynistic or homophobic slurs, we get lurid scenes and situations. The question I always come back to is, how much of this was necessary to create the grittiness that the author is going for? And in that regard, I found it kind of uneven. And sometimes we go in the space of a single issue from ultra-violence to high camp to gritty melancholy to fever dream. And that's a difficult needle to thread for anybody in any medium, but when you've only got 20-odd pages of a comic issue to make it work, when it falls flat, it's very easy for the reader to get disengaged. I think Delano gets it right some of the time, and I give him points for trying. I suppose it's also important to remember, as you said, the comics landscape of the time was very superhero-dominated, but also trying to reinvent itself. So if you think about Silver Age Superman or whomever, each issue tends to hit a single note, and within a title, it tends to be the same note over and over. With what they call the modern or Dark Ages comics starting in the mid to late 80s, you have these experiments with interwoven stories and mixing the theme and moods. My guess is that Hellblazer just took a little longer to find its feet with that, so that these early era issues seem kind of all over the place in that regard. I also want to call out two specific moments from the first two trades. There's an arc where, if I have this right, Constantine makes a deal with his friend-slash-rival, the Swamp Thing, to impregnate the Swamp Thing's girlfriend, because being a kudzu spirit, he can't do it himself, and the whole thing just goes on way too long. But I think those issues, even though they were included in the first and second trades, they were actually from the Swamp Thing comic, so maybe that shouldn't count. Nevertheless, I got reader whiplash going from John's being haunted by the ghosts of his past and then sleeping with the religious fanatic's virgin sacrifice in order to foil their plans, to John is a possessed sperm donor in a melodramatic soap opera. So that was a little jarring. And then there's another issue where it's his ancestor, I guess, who's apparently this very vulgar pagan king of Britain in the centuries after Arthur. It's very self-importantly disgusting and over the top, and the more I think about it, the happier I am that for the film they took one of the more subdued takes on the character, if not the material. But I've certainly read worse, so it wasn't enough to turn me off from the series entirely, those little peccadilloes.
I thought the quality of the writing varied greatly. Some stories were great, others not as much. Sometimes the story got moving quickly, other times there were two issues of boredom before things got going. Most of what I read was written by Jamie Delano. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. I don't know why it is so inconsistent. Couldn't a DC editor keep a closer eye on submissions? I mean, I don't know the comics industry so well, but I just make assumptions like that. I remember a Jim Shooter interview where he said at Marvel he put the thumb screws on the X-Men writer, and it resulted in the Dark Phoenix story, which boosted sales. I'm not a big comics guy, but even I heard about the Dark Phoenix story. Also, Jamie Delano and Garth Ennis both used the comic as a soapbox at times. An occasional reference to the writer's own opinions is fine, but these two pushed their ideas about religion and politics more than they needed to. One story showed demons celebrating every time one particular political party won an election in Britain. The comic is a roundup of 80s newspaper headlines. As a result, some of the stories age a little poorly. After volume 2 of the trade paperback, there was too much navel-gazing. I mean, I don't want to sound insulting, but I mean, where a character just like looks back at his life and say, did I make mistakes? And it's like, I don't know. A page or two is all right, but a couple of issues together, psychoanalysis gets dull quickly. But Puka, did Hellblazer give you ideas for running or playing Mage?
There were some cool moments of description that I think would be helpful for running things like resonance or how a mage understands their own use of low-level effects. I do think Constantine probably has an Arete 2 if he's a mage. Comic books, they can artfully present the visual stuff that a character is encountering, but then with the little narrative boxes, you can get ideas about how they're interpreting it. At one point, John goes astrally projecting, and there are lines that feel like they were written directly for the role-playing game, like, these visual realities are all constructed by me to rationalize the essential world, and construct your future, mold reality into a pleasing shape. If I had to peg his paradigm in Mage 20th Anniversary terms, it would be a mix between consciousness is the only true reality, and everything is chaos, probably. Outside of a seeking, I'm not really sure how I would leverage these things into actually narrating scenes in a game, but it was still a good reminder to think about the individuality of each mage, not just in terms of how they use their magic and interact with the awakened world, but also the mundane mortal side of things, and how those two sides interact, and how they interpret all of that. More specifically, the sequences involving the cybersphere and all of its 24K dial-up glory, I would 100% use those for scenes in the digital web. Probably my favorite part of these issues. Glorious. There were a number of moments where Constantine seems to be outright losing his mind for one reason or another, and I think that could provide a story structure for a mage going through quiet. And then I personally don't use the Infernal much in games, or the Celestial for that matter, but Nurgle the Demon is a great villain template for a chronicle for those who do. And the whole tension between heaven and hell and what they represent is a core theme, since Constantine himself is caught in the middle of it. Along those same lines, cults and the reality zones they create are a running theme through the first two trades, much more than cabals or any kind of, like, mages hanging out and getting things done together. So they demonstrate how community can corrupt just as thoroughly as individual power, if not more. And I think that would be a great theme to explore in a mage game.
Whether you're a player or a storyteller, there's plenty of inspiration and examples here. Some players like the idea of a street-savvy character but wonder how to portray such a figure. Hellblazer will show you. There are plenty of elements of the World of Darkness modeled here. The first story is two issues and gives you a great example of the contact's background. What's it like to know people? What's it like when you check with your contacts for info? When the player gets some intel, how can the storyteller show contacts need some care and feeding? Throughout the comic, we get a nice depiction of how the World of Darkness was presented in the 90s. Not the world of the 90s, but in the 90s Mage books, the World of Darkness setting was emphasized more clearly than in later years. If a storyteller wants a little help portraying this, this comic is here for you. Issues 10 and 12 give a depiction of astral space. It doesn't have to be just floating among the stars or a complete copy of the regular world surrounding the mage. Constantine walks through the ocean but reminds himself he's not really there. His mind is doing its best to translate astral space. Issue 12 has a good example of trickery instead of magic. If a mage can trick an ancient Umbrood into visiting the digital web, the mage has an advantage. In this particular issue, Constantine lets a demon chase him to the edge of heaven, where it gets fried by heaven's influence. How did Constantine know the way to heaven? Why should anyone assume heaven can be reached from computer networks? Anyways, this comic has things to offer us in our games. Okay, Puka, did Hellblazer give you any insights into the world of mage?
I think it gives some great examples of the aftermath if you're a high ritualist who botches their arete role, but... Something that often feels lacking to me in mage games is that the magic itself is treated as a means to an end rather than a thing to be experienced through. It's like, oh no, if you botch, you get paradox. But depending on a mage's approach, there can be really awful consequences to what they do, psychologically or materially, both to themselves and others. Even if they succeed, there can be those consequences. And the arc that explores John's group attempting a ritual in Newcastle and failing miserably, which is something that gets brought up again and again, that really drives that idea home and functions as kind of an origin story for why he is the way he is. And related to that, it is a reminder that hedge mages are pretty common. I said he had an arete too, but I would agree that he's more of a hedge mage than a proper awakened avatar everything mage. At least in this part of the series, neither the protagonist nor his friends and colleagues are what I would call mages in the metaphysical sense. They're just people who mess around. For every mage, there are probably a dozen people traumatized by what they've seen and done, and then half of those are maimed or dead. So it harkens back to the idea that what really sets proper mages apart from mortals in a game stat sense is their willpower. John survives in part due to his luck, in part due to his wits, and in part due to resolve. I'd also say it demonstrates how horror is present in the game's world. Mage doesn't often lean into the personal horror as much as vampire, for example, but it certainly can. So if we treat the Newcastle ritual as kind of an awakening arc, because that's the moment John goes from, you know, kind of dabbling to being fully involved, maybe that is his awakening, at least in his mentality. It shows how that process can be rooted in trauma. And this is where he begins to understand that messing with those forces in any capacity has these consequences. The second trade has this two-issue story called Antarctica that started off another comic series called The Horrorist. And in addition to having really eerily beautiful art by David Lloyd, it shows how ugly human nature can be. And if the supernatural is often just a mirror for humanity, well, there you go. And what's the point of the World of Darkness if not that? I will also remark that this stuff is not for everybody, but for those who want to incorporate that angle into a character, I think Hellblazer is a useful text for doing that. You just have to package it with, like, every content warning imaginable.
For me, there are no insights into the world of Mage in this comic. Hellblazer was not an inspiration when Mage was being created in 1993. It may have been an inspiration for Destiny's Price, but it could just as easily have been mentioned in that book because it showed London's grim neighborhoods. It's impossible to say. Hellblazer doesn't line up well with World of Darkness magic. In issue 11, a young Constantine states, "Summoning demons is like cooking. Follow the recipe and it happens." In the World of Darkness, hedge wizards need training and practice before their rituals do anything, same for mages. The power of true names is part of the hermetic paradigm. Cultists of ecstasy don't worry about it much. In Hellblazer, there are no paradigms. The power of true names is absolute fact. While we're talking about mismatches, one stood out for me. Traditional Christian notions of heaven and hell, angels and demons show up repeatedly in these stories. However, the writers present them quite differently from Western tradition. Although they have the names and appearances of Christian lore, the forces of heaven and hell presented in Hellblazer conform to dualism. The two are equal in power, influence, moral character, goals, and many other things. Constantine understands this and plays them off against each other to protect humans who are stuck in the middle. Puka, did Hellblazer inspire you to change something about how you run Mage?
Honestly, it does make me more likely to run a sorcerer game. As I mentioned, I really like street-level stuff, but dynamic magic with a K ratchets everything up pretty quickly. So it's better for games that start street level and rise above it, whereas the hard boundaries of linear magic are maybe more suited to a game that's going to stay at that level. And to my knowledge, Constantine never really gains superpowers or anything, except maybe, as you said, in Books of Magic. He knows his own limits. To me, that's part of the distinction between games that are just a non-stop race to level up and the ones where characters have to consider the changes they're effecting in the world. Even in a game with standard avatars and all mages, I'm always on the lookout for ways to prioritize the latter. John also knows when to quit, sometimes better than his peers. So that scene where the Lord of Hell is chasing him through the digital web and is all, "Stand and fight!" And Constantine's like, "Are you out of your mind? Discretion is the better part of valor," etc. So in a game, it's helpful to know the point where each character in a party will nope out of a situation. Players should try to reduce the bleed with their characters and think about the specific moments that their character would be reckless and stick to it even when it's risky. And storytellers should acknowledge that tempting players into risky situations won't always be successful and roll with it rather than trying to drag them into a plot they don't want, especially if their actions haven't earned that level of consequence. Going back to the Antarctica arc, at the end of it, it's a slight spoiler here, John as a character has his altruism restored, but he essentially gets there by sacrificing himself and admitting his own brokenness to a being who's equally broken, albeit for different reasons. And that reads to me like a seeking or a vision quest that does ultimately get him back on his path, instead of killing him, which is what happens to everybody else who encounters this being. If Mage as a system lacks a morality stat, and you want to model something where the characters do have to learn and grow from the internal consequences of their actions, seekings are a great space to do that in. And that's the kind of thing I'd like to see more of in role-playing games in general. I mean, action is fun and all, but it can get relentless. And I like when characters and their players really pause and think about what they've done, for better and or worse. So I think those two issues are good inspiration for when a character stops running from their problems, as John frequently does, and confronts them. Confronts himself, even. But I'm probably not more likely to run Infernal stuff. I have good ideas from this text, maybe ideas better than ones I'd get from certain mage books with the same themes that will remain unnamed. It just doesn't inspire me as much. I remember, I think it was Faulkner who said that the best stories were about the human heart in conflict with itself. And mages are certainly hubristic enough that they can be their own downfall without any help from outside. So those were the aspects of Hellblazer that I gravitated towards.
Yeah, although this comic can help our games, when it comes to changing something in my games, I only have one idea. In issue 6, a demon takes 4 human thugs, physically forces them together to form a monstrosity, and sends that monstrosity to kill Constantine. Constantine is taken by surprise, so he relies on his wits. He sees tattoos from opposing sports teams on different arms of this monster, and gets the monster to argue with itself. Then he escapes. I should give more thought to the importance of distractions. Whether it's hedge wizards or mages, distractions can be a lifesaver in a pinch. When timed well, a manipulation plus subterfuge or other skill shouldn't be too hard to pull off and should grant a tangible benefit. However, I want my player to come up with a reasonable line in the moment instead of saying, "My character will think of something." Also, with more intelligent or dedicated NPCs, this should be harder. And finally, Puka, does this title belong on the Mage recommended reading list? If so, one edition or all the editions of Mage?
Just briefly before I answer that, I will also say that that monstrosity in particular could also put this on the Vampire recommended reading list because it was a direct inspiration for the Blood Brothers bloodline in that game, which I only found out about after I'd already read it. But
oh, cool.
That's an aside. for Mage, I'll say yes, again with content warnings. There are hundreds of issues across dozens of arcs written by many writers, drawn by many artists, so I think it's hard to make a single blanket statement about the whole series. In terms of picking an edition, even if it wasn't actually recommended for Revised, I feel like the power level and tone of Revised is maybe a better match than like first edition or even second edition. But given how many things in those first two trades I can point to and say, oh, that's like insert thing here in Mage, it certainly feels informative to the core material of the game across editions. And any occult-themed comic that goes on for that long must have a number of story arcs that could be adopted into the game. I mean, I assume all of the things that I'm saying about street-level play was on the minds of the game's authors when they were working on it, maybe not in the core book, but later on. And the themes of Hellblazer have also been present in Mage, though foregrounded or backgrounded to different degrees at different times. Overall, though, I think that makes it an enduring inspiration. I'll admit that these first two trades didn't compel me to run out and buy the rest of the series, but I feel like I've read enough to say that it fits better with the game than a lot of similar fare. Maybe I would say it would crack the top five among mainstream publisher comics that do that. The film is a separate question, but yeah.
Yeah, I also saw the 2005 Hollywood movie with Keanu Reeves, and since we're talking about John Constantine, I liked the movie, but I can agree with fans of the comic book who said, that's not my John Constantine. They do have a point there. So yeah, I like the movie with reservations. Well, I don't think Mage fans will disagree with me when I say this belongs on the recommended reading list for all editions. I want to reiterate here, when I say something belongs on the list, I'm not saying it's good or I like it. It has to either give insight into how Mage or one of its elements was created or help us run Mage stories. This gives multiple examples of things that are tough for some storytellers and players. Issue 17 gives a detailed look at a marauder or the New World Order using a psychological attack on a moving train. Everyone on board is affected, and the result is like a nightmare. Why wouldn't you use this in your game? Volume 3 is a 9-issue story that features a secret organization setting up a fear machine to make overwhelming psychological attacks on crowds. Whether they are mages or hedge wizards doesn't matter. It's a great example of a story you could offer your players. We see the initial warnings that something is wrong. We see the info-gathering efforts of the hero and its complications. An initial conflict, regardless how it plays out, is exciting and can't break your story. The hero gets help. Final confrontation. Magic has to be used in the final confrontation. If you can't think of a story and adapt this one, I really doubt your players will complain. Well, that's the end of our discussion of John Constantine Hellblazer. If you're wondering what these two nuts are talking about, don't worry, we reality deviants are often misunderstood. I consider it a point of pride that my thinking goes beyond the capabilities of the average man. Or maybe I'm just weird. But never mind that. I'm not done with you listeners yet. If I get my way, we'll bring you an episode on Sandman. Not the song from 1954. Not the Spider-Man villain either. I'll explain next time. Until then, tell your friends about Reality Deviants Book Club. Madness loves company. Or was it Misery that loves company? I wouldn't work for a company called Misery. This episode is a part of Mage the Podcast, until they discover us anyways. If you would like to let us know what you think, send an email to magethepodcast@gmail.com. You can subscribe to Mage the Podcast on iTunes, Google Play, TuneIn, and other aggregators. If you like the show, and don't worry about what others think, you can leave a review online. Those reviews help other people find the show in their searches. And as the folks downstairs say, there's always room for one more. You can follow us on Twitter, @MageThePodcast. We're on the web at MageThePodcast.com. We're on YouTube. There's a link in the show notes, but just search for Mage the Podcast, and you'll find us there. If you would like to become an executive producer for this podcast, a link in the show notes will help you do that. No one would blame you for Reality Deviants Book Club. Well, thanks everyone for listening. Until next time, truth until paradox, baby.